Chapter 42, The Shaka Delusion. South Africans, and the rest of the world for that matter, have grown up with stories about Shaka, the world's most famous or infamous early 19th century African. Some consider him a genocidal maniac who forged the Zulu kingdom in fire and blood. Some worship him as Africa's Napoleon, a heroic military genius with superhuman abilities. For others, he's both. But what we've learned about him is mostly a pack of fibs, says Professor Dan Wiley of Rhodes University, who has spent a great chunk of his life researching the formal and informal histories of Shaka. According to Wiley, a combination of politically motivated myth-building, outright lies, culturally biased misconceptions, sloppy scholarship, and unthinking repetition has created a historiographical Frankenstein's monster for which there is no evidence. The lies began with colonial-era writers who embellished what little there was in the historical record to turn Shaka into a murderous monster. In the 1830s, British writers such as Nathaniel Isaacs and Henry Francis Finn created stereotypes of savage Africans because there was a market and a political appetite for them. Isaacs' advice to Finn when he started writing a book on Shaka and his successor Dingaan was, "Make them out as bloodthirsty as you can, and endeavor to give an estimation of the number of people they have murdered during their reign, and describe the frivolous crimes people lose their lives for. Introduce as many anecdotes relative to Shaka as you can. It all tends to swell up the work and makes it interesting." The books of these two frontier ruffians cemented Shaka's image as a psychopathic killer, an image that provided moral justification for Europeans' occupation of Africa. It also fed into the empty land myth and the Mfikane, Shaka's signature achievement or crime, which the history professor Julian Cobbing began dismantling in the late 1980s. Shaka supposedly depopulated vast areas, rendering the interior a wasteland, so white people could settle there with no moral qualms. By the 1950s, the worldview of Africa had started to shift, and early post-colonialists began to valorize African culture and tap into strands of Zulu nationalism. E.A. Ritter, who described himself as a bush scientist, took advantage of these political shifts with his 1955 biography, Shaka Zulu, which reinforced the king as vicious and cruel, but also conveyed a more positive, nationalistic image of him as a warrior. At first reading, Ritter's book appears to be a fairly sober biographical account, but when Wiley took a closer look, he discovered it was pure fiction. He had access to the original manuscripts and saw the book had started out as a ghastly sex and gore potboiler. A ghostwriter transformed the manuscript from fiction into a work of history, shaping Shaka's image as a leader who won all his battles and forged a unified nation. The way it was written, or rather rewritten, made it sound like history. And because it read like history, it became accepted as history and has been cited in mainstream histories such as Donald Morris's popular The Washing of the Spears, the Oxford History of South Africa, and the Encyclopedia Britannica. Many of the enduring Shaka myths come from Ritter's biography, most of which, says Wiley, is nonsense. A lot of them were regurgitated in the 10-part TV series Shaka Zulu, directed by Bill Forer for the SABC in 1986. In fact, when people think of Shaka, they visualize Henry Qele, the buff football player who acted as the Zulu king. The series, seen by more than 300 million people in 85 countries within 2 years, was billed as a historical account of the rise and downfall of Shaka, but it had a generous lashing of poetic license. In what may be the world's most tone-deaf statement, Forer, a white man, explained what he wanted to achieve in directing the series. "Black history suffers because it is mainly written by whites. I felt it was time to rewrite the black history books." Forer, who was later accused of being a propagandist for military intelligence, portrayed Shaka as a noble savage. When Wiley watched Shaka Zulu, he was horrified that this was the image of Zulu life and culture being portrayed in South Africa and around the world. African spirituality was reduced to screeching gothic light shows, and Shaka was depicted as a snarling killing machine, he shudders. The authenticity of the series extended, as the New York Times put it, to great waves of bare breasts and buttocks. South Africa's puritanical censors turned a blind eye to the nudity and allowed it to be screened on the SABC, probably because it promoted tribalism and Zulu nationalism, which fed into the government's Bantustan policy of separate nations. The series spurred Wiley's mission to determine what it is possible to know about Shaka and dislodge the ironclad misconceptions about him. He interrogated sources, reassessed written accounts, and analyzed neglected oral histories, discarding dubious anecdotes, embellishments, biases, flaws, misrepresentations, distortions, and uncertainties. There wasn't much left. Not even the most basic biographical facts of when Shaka was born, what he looked like, or precisely why or when he was assassinated, never mind his inner motivations. The results of his quest are his books Savage Delight, White Myths of Shaka, and Myth of Iron, Shaka in History, which Wiley describes as an anti-biography, because material for a trustworthy biography does not exist. Wiley examines Shaka as a flesh-and-blood human with flaws and contradictions who worked within political, physical, technological, and ecological constraints. He concludes that, yes, he was a tough and sometimes brutal leader, but those were brutal times. In contemporary England, for example, people were hanged for stealing a loaf of bread. Wiley says Shaka viewed life realistically and believes he would appreciate an assessment of him that wasn't either a superhuman hero, military genius who was brilliant at everything, or an inhumane monster who killed off entire tribes and threw people off cliffs. Despite all the novels, films, TV shows, plays, poems, academic papers, operas, biographies, and the one anti-biography devoted to Shaka, the Zulu King remains a mysterious figure, South Africa's megamyth. There's so much that's not known about Shaka, and to be true to history, we must accept that we don't know and stop inventing facts to fill in the gaps, says Wiley. Shaka has become a symbol of Zulu power and African unity, something Mangosuthu Buthelezi amplified when he formed the Zulu-based Inkatha Freedom Party in 1975. He had Shaka Day declared a provincial holiday in Natal on 24 September, the presumed date of his assassination in 1828. Shaka Day didn't make it into post-apartheid South Africa's list of public holidays, but the cult of Shaka did. KwaZulu-Natal is full of Shaka iconography. King Shaka International Airport, Shaka Beach, Ushaka Marine World, and King Shaka Avenue. In 2010, when a 3.2 million rand statue of a spearless Shaka surrounded by cattle was unveiled at the Durban airport, the Zulu Royal House complained that an unarmed Shaka symbolized surrender and made him look like a herd boy, not a warrior king. The statue was quickly removed, and for more than a decade, the cows have stood alone, waiting for a new Shaka to join them. But perhaps the empty space is the most fitting monument for an enigmatic historical figure we know so little about. Shaka by his anti-biographer. Professor Dan Wiley helps untangle the truth from the myths about the Shaka I thought I knew. Jonathan Answer. Shaka's mother, Nandi, had an affair with Senzanga Kona and fell pregnant. Senzanga Kona claimed Nandi wasn't pregnant, but had a stomach ailment caused by the Ishaka beetle. When Shaka was born, Nandi sent him to Senzanga Kona and said, "Here is your little beetle." And that's how Shaka got his name. Dan Wiley. This is the story related by the priest anthropologist A.T. Bryant, then by Ritter, and thenceforward by everyone else. The great warrior hero was named after a beetle? It's funny, ironic, and irresistible, but is it true? I think the beetle story is unlikely. How did the beetle, called Itshati, as some Zulu themselves comment, become Shaka? Much more likely is that Shaka's given name, Sikiti, was superseded by the praise name, he who beats, Chakati, and is not beaten, earned in early adulthood. Jonathan Answer. When Shaka was a small boy, he and Nandi were sent into exile by an angry Senzanga Kona. Dan Wiley. There are several variations on the exile story, none entirely verifiable. I favor the theory that Shaka was only sent away by his father as a young adult when he began to throw his weight around. Jonathan Answer. Shaka was teased because he was illegitimate and grew up wanting to rule over his bullies. Dan Wiley. True or not, the childhood bullying story would later be used by historians as a simplistic Freudian tool to explain Schacke's alleged brutality. And the illegitimacy story would later be used, if not invented, by Schacke's half-brother Dingaan to justify assassinating him. Jonathan Anser. What struck me about Schacke were the tales of military prowess and his ruthlessness. My primary school teacher, Miss Melman, told us how Schacke forced his warriors to walk barefoot over thorns to toughen the soles of their feet and made them run for days so they would never tire in battle. I remember worksheets with a drawing of Schacke in animal skins holding a shield and a short-handled blade, which we were told he had invented after realizing that long throwing spears were useless in battle. This particular lesson struck Clive Goldstein because to demonstrate the effectiveness of stabbing a short blade into an enemy during hand-to-hand combat, Miss Melman plunged a ruler into Clive's belly. The worksheet also had a sketch of the buffalo horn formation Schacke had invented, with dotted lines illustrating how his warriors were divided into units to pin down his enemies. Schacke, Miss Melman explained, used this strategy to slaughter his enemies and swallow up smaller tribes to create a vast Zulu empire. Dan Wiley. Of course, training of some sort must have happened, but the story of the thorns was invented by E.A. Ritter in his sketchy biography of Schacke in 1955. There's plenty of evidence that the Xhosa and Ndwandwe, among others, used spears to stab with prior to Schacke, but he may have refined or sharpened this tactic. Same with the chest and horns tactic, which was refined from common hunting practice. However, among the Zulu records, there is little evidence it was ever used successfully. On only one or two occasions, as against the longtime invaders, the Ndwandwe, is there evidence of widespread slaughter. Schacke's martial successes are exaggerated. He did less conquering than imagined. He had a few battles, some of them were successful, some not. But Schacke's much preferred strategy was to have small impis carrying out targeted assassinations, followed by the insertion of more malleable leaders and cemented by marital ties or agreed alliances. Violence there was, unquestionably, but beware exaggeration of one vast nation. This kind of language arises from comparisons made early on to Napoleon, and Schacke and the French military leader were not remotely alike in aims or scale. The Zulu polity was a conglomerate of allied peoples who still hold on to their individual identities today, Xhlubi, Mkize, etc., gradually acquiring Zulu status as they became lumped together by simple-minded colonials, later by Zulu nationalists, whose purposes weirdly took advantage of colonial boundary drawing. And it's more complex, of course, but Schacke surely began the process. P.S. I hope Clive survived. Jonathan Anser, yes, Clive survived, but the ruler didn't. I remember learning that Schacke killed Nandi, but was so devastated by her death that he killed anyone who didn't show enough grief and mourn properly. Dan Wiley, nonsense. Schacke's mother died of dysentery, and mourning largely followed standard practice, though there seemed to be some opportunistic killing, which Schacke immediately quashed. Jonathan Anser, one other thing I seem to have always known about Schacke, although I'm not sure it's something Miss Melman would have told a class of 10-year-olds, is that he was impotent. Dan Wiley, this is more invention based on the perception that Schacke did not formally marry, and more pseudo-psychology by social anthropologist Max Gluckman and historian Donald Morris, who wrote that Schacke was unquestionably a latent homosexual. At least one son seems fairly well attested, but Schacke didn't care to have done to him what he had done to usurp his own father. It was quite common for sons to violently usurp their fathers and to assassinate rival brothers. It's not wholly clear how Schacke took over from Senzangakhona, but it was not undisputed, and at least one brother was murdered in the process. It has been suggested that Schacke did not marry and/or disowned offspring because he didn't want the same to happen to him. Why he never bumped off obvious rivals Dingaan and Mkhangana, who finally killed him, is an enduring puzzle. Jonathan Anser, anything else? Dan Wiley, I drew on the research of fellow Schacke scholars, particularly Julian Cobbing, Carolyn Hamilton, John Wright, Norman Etherington, and John LeBand, who disagree with me to various degrees, people wanting to know more about Schacke or to read their work.